Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning call-in program. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. A paradox of our time is that just when it seems like so much is coming together in the world, so much seems to be coming apart. We could apply that paradox on many levels, but here's one. Technology allows us instant communication almost anywhere in the world, but many people feel more isolated than ever before. Why is that? Why should we be concerned, and what can be done about it? That pretty much sums up our agenda for this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is a therapist who has been working with issues of connection in his practice and his teaching. Dr. Edward Hallowell is a psychiatrist who lectures at Harvard Medical School. He's also director of the Hallowell Center for Cognitive and Emotional Health in Concord, Massachusetts. Dr. Hallowell is a co-author of the books Driven to Distraction and Answers to Distraction, and the author of Worry, a book we had a chance to discuss with him on this program a couple of years back. His new book is entitled Connect, 12 Vital Ties That Open Your Soul, Lengthen Your Life, and... Connect, 12 Vital Ties That Open Your Heart, Lengthen Your Life, and Deepen Your Soul. And lest anyone accuse us of not being ambitious enough, we'll try to do all that during this hour of the show. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana. The number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other states where our signal travels, 800-222-9455. Within the 217 area code 333-WILL, outside that area code 800-222-WILL. Dr. Hallowell, good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be with you again.
Well, glad to have you back.
And let me just turn off this other telephone.
Speaking of disconnection.
Yeah, really, exactly. Well, the machine will take it if you can bear that ringing once more.
Okay. That's all right.
I'm sitting here at home, and I thought I had someone answering my telephone, but obviously I don't.
Okay. Well, stranger things have happened on this show, believe me, than a phone ringing in the background, so that's all right. Let me just begin to ask you to talk about what you mean by the problem of disconnection in modern life.
Well, and as you said in your very articulate introduction, it is such a paradox because we're obviously electronically connected miraculously. I mean, the world has never seen such a thing, and it's growing all the time, and it's really very wonderful. But at the same time, we seem to be unplugging from in-person relationships. We seem to be the family is not as strong as it once was. Neighborhoods have all but disappeared. You know, when I was a kid, I used to be able to do something after school that's now obsolete. It was called go out and play because I had a neighborhood, and those are hard to find. Organizations of all kinds seem to have become more impersonal. You feel less at ease walking around shopping malls. People don't smile and make eye contact. There's a kind of a pervasive formality, if not mistrust, that people live with, and this is not good for you. And that's the point of my book, is to sort of sound an alarm signal and say, look, we've got to reclaim connections, because that's really what makes us happy in life. And guess what? It also makes us live longer. we've clearly established the fact that connected people are healthier and live longer. So there's every reason in the world to kind of reconnect and lay claim to a connected life. And everybody can do it if they'll simply try.
Let's just focus on that one note, the medical implications, which, I mean, there are many other things we could talk about.
Sure.
But there's this term that you use, and I love it. It's called, I'm not sure if you made it up or if, where it comes from, human contact deficiency.
Yes.
And you cite this study that was done by someone at Harvard that showed that people who had strong social ties live significantly longer than those who did not.
Exactly, yeah. No, I made up that term because we talk about vitamin deficiencies. Well, human contact deficiency is just as toxic. And it was Lisa Berkman, who was at that point in California, now she's at Harvard, who did a pioneering study back in the 70s in Alameda County, California, and followed over 10 years some 11,000 members of that community of all socioeconomic strata. And she assessed how connected these people were. Did they live alone or by themselves? Did they keep up with friends? Were they members of organizations? Did they belonged to organizations that they found sustaining. And what she found was very impressive, that the connected people lived longer than the disconnected people. Now, mortality, i.e. death, had never been linked to social connection before. But since she did that study, which was published in 1979, there have been over a dozen replications of that study, and they all find the same finding. So that now doctors refer to social isolation as a risk factor on the same order of magnitude as cigarette smoking in terms of dying young. It is just as important for you to lead a connected life, and this is statistically proven. It is just as important from a health standpoint for you to lead a connected life as it is for you to quit smoking. That's a very powerful finding. Most people are not aware that they think, oh, well, it's just a feel-good finding to be connected. No, it's much more profound than that. It actually affects mortality.
It's interesting because we talk about, you know, in terms of human health, improving health, we talk about things like quitting smoking and adopting a healthier lifestyle, whether it be habit, dietary habits or exercise.
Wear your seatbelt.
Et cetera, et cetera. But we don't necessarily talk about having a social life.
Exactly. And this is one bit of health advice that actually ought to be fun, you know. I mean, you don't have to go on a diet or, you know, take drugs to lower your cholesterol. All you have to do is make a date with a friend every week. If you reserve a time for a lunch date with a friend once a week, an hour a week, you'll be adding years to your life. I mean, it is, and the steps you can take are so simple. If you resolve to have family dinner, if you can't do it every night, do it twice a week. Or if you can't have family dinner, have midnight popcorn. Or, you know, if you structure in your life these moments of connection, be it with family, a friend, if you go back to church or synagogue or meditation center, whatever, some spiritual congregation, and that's important that there be a group of people. If you have a pet, if you even tend a garden, that's a kind of connection too. If you do these simple steps, you will guaranteed not only feel better, as if that weren't enough, but you'll live longer and you'll be more productive. People think, particularly these days, as we're all so busy, that the key to longevity and being safe in this world is making a lot of money. And sure, making a lot of money is fine, but the key is not that. The key is leading a connected life.
There are also connections with academic performance, and I'm referring in particular to a study that you did at Phillips Exeter Academy, a place that you attended.
Yes.
You went back there after years and looked at the effect of connectedness on academic performance. Tell us
this
about that.
This was a very interesting study, because I had, for your listeners who don't know what Exeter is a very rigorous prep school up in New Hampshire, very traditional old-fashioned school that has very, very high academic standards. And I had attended Exeter and really loved Exeter, graduated in 1968. But one of the myths at Exeter had been the more it hurts, the better it is. In other words, sort of suffering is good for learning. Suffering correlates with high achievement. And that was kind of one of the foundations of the school. They would never come right out and say it, but it was clear. It was in the paint. And so I went back at the invitation of the principal to look at that. Mike Diamante, and a psychologist, and I collaborated, and we interviewed the students and looked at grade point average and looked at measures of depression and the whole nine yards of doing a study. But the remarkable finding that we came out with was that the kids who felt the most driven, i.e. who were the most stressed, the most getting high grades as a top priority and feeling that this is their mission in life, those were the kids who did the worst, who had the lowest grade point average, the highest level of stress, the highest level of depression, the highest level of substance abuse. And on the other hand, the kids who reported that what mattered to them most was connection, friendship, those were the kids who got the best grades. Those were the kids who were the most high achieving and reported the least stress, the lowest levels of depression, and the lowest levels of substance abuse. So precisely the opposite of what the culture had assumed, that high stress correlates with high achievement, the opposite holds. that low stress correlates with high achievement.
Amazing.
Yeah, I'm working with the Harvard Chemistry Department along the same lines and finding similar results.
Mm-hmm. Where does family play in this? Is it essential that there be a core of family connection? And I imagine in many cases that would be problematic.
Well, it's nothing is this. See, the great thing about connectedness is no one connection is essential. I found this as a kid. In fact, the reason I really feel so passionately about connection is I learned firsthand the power of it. I came from a very crazy New England family characterized by what I call the WASP triad of alcoholism, mental illness, and politeness. And so I grew up in a core family where there was very little stability. You know, the dad was manic depressive, mom was alcoholic, and then a stepfather was alcoholic and abusive. So I didn't have any real sustaining connections at home. But I found those connections outside the home, in teachers and coaches and friends' parents. And those connections saved me. Those connections really rescued me from, statistically speaking, what should have been a miserable outcome in terms of my life. I'm now happily married with three wonderful little kids and having the joyous experience of giving them what I didn't have as a child. But so you don't have to have one connection. You can always find it elsewhere, and that's one of the beauties of connection. If you're open to them, if you don't have it at home, you can find it outside of the home. And we have studies that show this, not just my personal experience, but real hard studies showing that.
Mm-hmm. You write that the essence of making connection is the human moment, but the human moment is disappearing from modern life. What can you say about why that is?
Well, first of all, to define the human moment, it's just a term I use to refer to any moment when people are together in each other's presence, live. Mm-hmm. You and I right now, it's not quite a human moment because we're doing it over the telephone. If we were sitting face to face, then that would be a human moment.
Right.
And the reason I use the term is because it's disappearing. Why is it disappearing? Well, the obvious reason is technology has allowed us to avoid it, and that's a great blessing. I'm not damning technology at all. I love technology. But we just got to be careful that we don't overuse it and let the human moment disappear. Because of email, because of voicemail, because of cell phones, because of fax machines, all of that, we are allowed to do our daily business without ever sitting down and talking to someone face-to-face. That's a blessing in one sense because it makes everything more efficient, but it's real dangerous in another sense because there are times when you absolutely need to sit down with that person, as anxiety-provoking as it might be, as cumbersome as it might be. You might have to fly across the country or walk across the hallway, but you need to sit down face-to-face now and then. To build trust, to work out differences, to have emotional bridges, and if you dispense with that entirely, bad things happen.
We're talking this morning with Dr. Edward Hallowell. He is the author of several books, among them Worry, Controlling It and Using It Wisely, which came out a couple years ago, and the one we're talking about this morning, Connect, 12 Vital Ties That Open Your Heart, Lengthen Your Life, and Deepen Your Soul, just published by Pantheon Books. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can do so, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere, 800-222-9455. I want to get on and talk about other things, but just kind of a follow-up on the issue of technology and the issue of why the human moment is disappearing from modern life. Can technology bring us together? I'm curious about your thoughts about this. Via email, people can stay in touch with each other even if they're not geographically close. And in some ways, some people say it's more immediate and intimate than previous ways of communication and so forth. Is that kind of doomed to failure?
Oh, no. Email absolutely can bring people closer together. I just flew home from Seattle on an airplane with a man who was telling me how he'd met his wife on the internet. And he said he was very shy and he just couldn't meet women. And lo and behold, he struck up this romance and it was not a sham. It was real. And then they met in person and they were just as good in person as they'd been on email. And now they're very happily married. And he said, I wouldn't have met her otherwise. So, that's a dramatic example. But in in milder ways, lots of families now who are scattered about the country stay in touch by email. It's a marvelous tool. It's handy. It's efficient. I use it every single day. It's incredible. It's phenomenal. I'm a huge fan of email.
Uh-huh.
All I'm saying is, if you use it to replace your social life, if you use it completely to replace it, then that's dangerous. If your social life consists of nothing but chat rooms, that's not going to be sustaining. You need it to augment your social relationships, not to replace them.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Technology is not the only change, though, in modern urban culture. It seems that civic institutions like schools and churches are really trying to do more heavy lifting than they used to create communities where they were once sort of taken for granted. I mean, do you think that's right? Do you think that, like, the neighborhood has changed and our way of relating to each other in terms of being close-knit in a more traditional sense? Is something basic in the culture change that sort of...
I think so. Yeah. I really think so. And, you know, some people say it started with air conditioning, which allowed people to, instead of sitting out on the stoop in summers, they could now go inside. But whether it was started with air conditioning or television or telephone or computer or whatever, we have gradually gone inside more. Neighborhoods are not the public meeting places that they used to be, people chatting over the fence and providing a kind of extended holding environment for children to grow up in. It's hard to find those kind of places. They do exist, but it's much harder to find them. People have tended to go inside. They've tended to pull back. And so they interact with a kind of civility, maybe, sometimes not, but with a kind of formality, but not a kind of open-hearted trust. And I think it's real important that we reclaim that.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all yearn for it. I think we want it. But you can't just walk outside and have it. You have to work at it. You have to invest in it. You have to lay the groundwork and get to know your neighbors and have them over for a barbecue and these kind of things that we say, oh, we don't have time for that, or maybe I don't like my neighbors, or maybe I'd rather watch TV. And those are decisions we make. And the point of my book is there's a price you pay that's probably higher than you might think for your solitude, for your vegging out hours.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's go ahead and do that and welcome others. 333-WILL around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. We have a listener in Bloomington on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning.
Yes.
My life has been almost an antithesis of what you've been talking about this morning. And I'm going to have my 85th birthday soon.
That's very good.
How has it been the antithesis?
Well, because I'm almost opposite, directly opposite from the type of thing that you've been saying that gives you longevity.
How do you mean? How?
Because I've been a loner practically all my life.
Uh-huh. And what do you have for connections?
Connection with what? What are you speaking of?
Do you feel connected to anything outside
of... Very little. Very little.
Do you have a pet?
No religion.
Do you have a pet?
No, I don't.
Do you have a garden?
I have tomato plants.
Yeah? Do you read books?
And something that you apparently have in the title of your book, you mentioned soul.
Right.
As I've told you just a few moments ago that I'm going to be 85.
Right.
And I have not figured out yet where my soul is. I asked someone one time where my soul was when I was under general anesthesia, which I have been several times in my life.
Right.
Can you tell me where was my soul?
Well, it's not a part of your anatomy that you can look at under a microscope. Mm-hmm. It's a part of you that kind of fills you up and is invisible. But let me ask you another question. What makes you happy in your life?
I can't say that I'm very happy most of the time.
Okay. Well, I think if you had a more connected life, you probably would be a happier person.
Then I would be able to live twice 85.
So. No, it's not. Longevity alone is not the goal of life, I don't think. I mean, we don't want to live 85 miserable years. I think we'd like to.
I'm not miserable.
No, I know you're not. I know you're not. I know you're not miserable. I'm saying, but I say
I
longevity.
Enjoy my life.
Longevity alone is not the goal of life. I think the goal of life is to add something to the world and have a sense of satisfaction and completeness. And usually that happens with people who are connected, and usually that doesn't happen with people who are disconnected. Now, you may be a great exception to the rule.
I think I must be.
Yeah.
I enjoy things very much. For example, listening to Jack's program this morning.
Well, there you are.
I enjoy listening to that.
You connect. There you have it.
That's a connection.
You bet it is, absolutely. And you're calling in, and it even doubles the connection.
A rather tenuous one, I would say.
Well,
okay. You still haven't told me where my soul was while I was...
Now, you can't be so concrete. The fact that you can't put your finger on it doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Yeah, I see. Okay, thanks very much.
Well, thanks
okay.
for the call. You know, two things I want to say in response to that, and I don't mean to make light of the caller's points at all.
Right.
First of all, I consider it a very, very hopeful sign that people are calling us looking for their soul.
Yes.
And the second thing is that I do think that there is a connection among our listeners by sharing in the conversations that we have on this program. It may not be a face-to-face thing, but it is an order of connection that all too often is missing, especially when it comes to public dialogue on issues that we all perhaps, you know, need to be concerned with.
Absolutely. Shows like yours that have a regular listening audience, there's an invisible connection there, absolutely. And that's why it's so great when people do call in. To kind of speak from that silent body out there,
right.
Because you're reaching people that you don't even know, and then they're all in concert, but they haven't met each other. Someday you should have a party of all your listeners.
We've talked about it.
It would be a wonderful idea.
Yeah.
Let them meet each other.
That's right. Well, going on to talk about some of the causes and effects of disconnection, you make an interesting point in the book about the expansion of personal freedom sort of being part of the cause. And this is something that we celebrate, of course, in our culture, that
right.
people have opportunities to be and do things that, you know, in previous generations and centuries, they never would have had.
Right.
They would have been locked in traditional roles and relationships and hierarchies that were limiting, certainly, of their personal expression or whatever they want to do with their life, but at the same time sort of defined them and gave them a place. And this is really a major change in modern life.
Yeah, exactly. It's not just the technology that and the speeding up that has helped to disconnect us. It's also another paradox, the freedoms that we've gained. And they're good freedoms. You know, again, I'm not in any way saying turn back the clock. But as we have gained personal freedoms and as we have broken down social structures that were in need of breaking down, we don't quite know what to replace them with. You know, I mean, instead of the sexist family structure or instead of the exclusive racist country club structure or instead of the neighborhoods that were very exclusionary and so on and so forth, all those things needed to be broken down. All of those things needed to be changed. So we did that, or we tried to do it anyway. We've moved in that direction. But meanwhile, people don't quite know where they fit. They used to be told what their place was, and often in a very unfair way, but at least they knew their place. Now, none of us knows our place, and that's great. On the one hand, we have all kinds of opportunity, but it's a little discombobulating. On the other hand, we don't quite have the structures and the forums that we need. So I think the challenge of the coming decades is to recreate more fresh and vital and equal social structures that people can once again plug into.
And doing it in an intentional way.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. I mean, something as simple yet essential as dating is awfully hard for a lot of people because they don't know where to plug in. There's an awful lot of single people out there who are looking, and they're turning to dating services, and they're turning to the Internet. They're looking for these new structures to help find a mate in life. And the old structures that were often unfair and really repugnant in many ways are gone, and that's good, but now we got to invent new ones.
You talk about, in the book, you have a section on the 12 points of connection. I wonder if I could ask you to talk about that a bit, because perhaps we might be tempted to oversimplify and say that when we talk about connection, we're just talking about friendships with people or family, but it's a bit broader than that.
Yeah, it's very much broader, and that's what I tried to make explicit, what I did make explicit in the book. And I talk about 12 different areas of connection, and family and friends are three of the areas. I talk about the family you're born into, and if you're adopted, the family that raises you, as well as your biological family, so that's one. And then the family you create as an adult, the family that you create on your own as an adult, and then the group of friends, neighborhood, community, that's your third domain of connection. But I talk about nine more, and so this connected life can be a lot broader than you may think at first. For example, I include the past as an important connection. A lot of people don't necessarily think of the past as something they're connected to, but it's very important. Do you have a sense of where you came from? Do you feel connected to your grandparents? Do you feel a sense of tradition in your ethnic group, in your geographical region? Do you feel connected by, sustained by the past? Or even are you connected to it in a negative way where you're basically rebelling against it? That's a kind of connection as well. Are you defined by your opposition to the past? So the connection need not be an embrace, but an awareness of the past. And that's a very important connection a lot of people grow up without these days, any awareness whatsoever of why they're here or where they came from, what their ancestors did to get them here.
Some of my favorite writers often write about connection to a place.
Yes.
And it seems to me that this is one thing that our geographic mobility has perhaps deprived us of, at least in the sense that we used to have in the past.
Yes.
Not to be too nostalgic about things, but it seems to be really true. There's a writer in Indiana, Scott Russell Sanders, who writes wonderfully about his effort to learn about the place where he lives, about its history, about its geography, its natural areas, and so forth, so as to connect himself with that place.
And that's a wonderful, you see, and he has to put an effort in to do that. It doesn't just, but if he does that, he begins to send out little tendrils that then become roots, and the next thing you know, he has a connection. And as you say, you have to spend a little time in a place to feel that. Most of us feel a connection to the place we grew up in, unless we were so mobile we didn't spend any time anywhere very long. I grew up in Chatham on Cape Cod, and back then in the 50s was a little fishing village, and I feel a tremendous sense of place there. I mean, the town, the vegetation, the architecture, the town library, the smell of the books, the smell of the salt air, walking the beach. I mean, all of those images and the aspects of place grip me in a way that goes way beyond words and way beyond belief systems. I mean, they grip me in my glandular system. You know, I mean, it's a deep and powerful connection to place. And I think again, if you honor places and learn about them and invest your emotional energy in them, they then start giving back to you in an amazing kind of way. A lot of people will feel that about certain places in nature, maybe a particular mountain, or maybe just a particular restaurant. Even you can feel this connection to a place.
In working with you see a wide number of people, in your teaching and in your practice. How do you approach sort of assessing where people are in these different areas of connection? Because I mean, we've talked about family and friends and place and so forth, but there, in the past and so forth. But even connecting with yourself can be a major barrier to getting on with things.
Yeah, I assess it with people by asking one of the questions I asked the gentleman who called in. I ask him, what makes you happy in life? And then I ask him, what makes you unhappy in life? And those two questions usually give you a pretty good sense of where they're connected and where they're disconnected. most of the time what makes people happy are their positive connections. And most of the time what makes people unhappy are their disconnections or negative connections. And so those two very simple questions usually open the door to a whole panorama of stories and anecdotes. The stories of disconnection can be very painful, but the good news is even they can be repaired, even they can be revisited and revamped, and you can resurrect a connected life. All you have to do is resolve to do it. See that? Yeah. But a lot of folks don't buy it. You know, they say, I'm sorry, I'm too busy. I just can't. I can't afford it. Or easy for you to say, but you don't know my life. You don't know what I'm up against. And I just can't do it. Just can't make time for it. It's all I can do just to make ends meet. It's all I can do just get the laundry done, get the kids off for school, go out to my job, earn a living, get back home, get dinner on the table, wash the dishes, and go to bed. That's all I've got time for. And I say, look, I appreciate what you're up against, but people have been up against odds for all of human history, and yet they managed to find time to connect. And why in 1999 should we suddenly decide that it's impossible?
Do you think that where people have major areas of disconnection in their life, perhaps some history of trauma that they have yet to really deal with, this is something that, you know, perhaps they need to address, but also the other side of that is areas where they could make easy forward progress where there aren't necessarily obstacles to connection, or is this sort of, you know, you have to take a holistic approach, try to heal those areas of disconnection while, you know, bridging new connections with other areas?
But I agree with what you said. I think you ought to, you know, go where it's easy first.
Yeah.
Expand where there are no obstacles first, and then tackle the real hot spots later. Because the hot spots are hot for a reason, and if they're not going to give way easily, it's better that you sort of build up some emotional strength by going with connections that come naturally, and then go back and try to heal the pain. Others may disagree with that, but I don't think you should start with what's difficult. I think you should start with what comes naturally, and good news is for almost everybody, one connection or another is out there that would come naturally. Having lunch with a friend, having a pet, tending a garden, hooking up with some volunteer organization you believe in. Whatever it might happen to be for you, start with that, what comes easily and naturally. And then think about making peace with the parent that you're estranged from, or getting back to the sibling that you right now can't stand, or whatever the difficult one might happen to be.
In talking with a few friends, I find that many of us, and this goes for me as well, I'm sorry to say, have really lost touch with people who have come into our lives and meant something, whether they're friends or colleagues or teachers or fellow students, etc. And then they move on, and we just kind of lose touch with each other. And I think that a lot of people feel that as time goes on, it's almost not okay to get back in touch with folks.
Right.
You know, what would you say about that?
Well, I'd say, first of all, it's a sign of the times, and don't feel alone. There's a lot of folks who feel that way. They're sort of, oh, how can I, you know, go back there, that sort of thing.
What would I mean to that person now?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, kind of how should I presume, you know, things are different, you can't go home again,
yeah.
All that sort of conventional wisdom. And I say just the opposite. I say the other person will be so pleased, so surprised, so they may be at first taken aback and not know what to say, but they want it as much as you do. We all want it. See, that's the big secret. We all are looking for this. We all want deeper connections. And so if you happen to be the one who takes the chance, who risks it, who risks looking silly, being rejected, you know, so on and so forth, 9 times out of 10, you're going to get paid back many times over. The other fellow is going to say, oh, thank God you called. You know, this is wonderful. And I've been thinking about you, and I never thought I'd see you again. And listeners right now, think of someone. And I'll bet you there's someone in every listener's life who you haven't seen in a long time, who used to mean a lot to you, who you could track down one way or another, give them a phone call, And boy, what a smile would come to both of your faces.
We have just about maybe 12 or 13 minutes left with our guest, Dr. Edward Hallowell. We're talking about his book, Connect. If you'd like to join the conversation before we run out of time, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It seems to me that this becomes, I mean, obviously it's a personal issue. It may pertain to our health and happiness as individuals. But also it seems that right now the world really needs to connect in some pretty major ways that we're not doing. And, you know, I'm thinking in the United States, we continue to have a problem with the color line, with racism, and with people feeling that other people are, you know, they're them, we're us. And we haven't yet bridged that gap. We haven't been able to connect across those lines. And when you look around the world, there are gaps in either culture or religion or class lines that almost seem unbridgeable. And I guess I'm you know, maybe I'm asking you to solve you know, the woes of the world in the next 10 minutes or so, but I mean, how do we get to this? I mean, just taking an example of in the United States, where we have disagreements or a feeling that you know, the racism is such a heavy legacy that we don't understand one another and can't really bridge that gap. What are some ways to approach that?
Well, I think you just have to start with the act of faith that there is no unbridgeable gap. And you're absolutely right. So many of the big problems in the world boil down to these local problems of disconnection. You know, in individual lives, people are just not able, for one reason or another, to get past some prejudice, some fear, some fundamental belief system that some other group is not to be trusted or is inferior or is in some way dangerous, and then because of that they begin to separate, and then this feeling of being put down grows up, or this reality of being put down grows up, and the next thing you know, you have people hating each other and fighting wars, and that's really what wars are all about. I mean, it begins with the model of the family feud, and you just extend that out into, you know, groups of people and ethnic groups of people and geographical groups of people. And so as you work at your capacity to connect and to go beyond your comfort zone with other people, that's the local way, the individual way of what the world needs to do as a whole. And I know we're not going to solve it as we sit here talking, but that's the direction we need to work. I mean, it's toward charity, it's toward understanding, it's toward connection with people that we feel different from, if not better than or worse than. Almost all of us feels put down by some group, and almost all of us probably put down some group. And we need to examine that, work on that, acknowledge it, and then try to get past it.
We have another call to talk with. Let's include them before we run out of time. This is a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, a big question and a little one. The big question is, do you have any feel, given the studies that have been done, for the shape of the response curve? I suspect that the first unit of connection does a person a lot more good than 101st unit. But I wonder if you have any sense of that.
No, it's more the continuance of it. In other words, the initial meeting and making the relationship, that may be associated with the greatest amount of pleasure, but in terms of the health benefits, it's continuing it.
Okay, I didn't make myself clear.
Okay.
What I meant was, if you're currently going along at some low level, and you go to that low level plus a rate of that low level plus one extending over time,
yeah,
that'll make a lot more difference than if you're going along at a rate of the low level plus 100 over time and you go to the low level plus 101 over time.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, the well-connected person who becomes a little bit more connected is not adding as much as the disconnected person who becomes more connected.
Okay. And Okay, so we have a diminishing returns curve. Well,
but in fact, you can get to where you're too connected, and so you need to weed out your garden a little bit. Some people overextend with connections. That's sort of the other extreme of what we're talking about.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, where you can have your energy drained by excessive connection. You're volunteering for too many organizations. You're keeping up with too many friends. You're being there for too many people, and you're wearing yourself out.
Uh-huh.
So you can sort of burn out on connections. I mean, that's the other extreme of the spectrum.
Okay. At the lower end, I mean, you've talked about having a garden as being some connection, having
right.
a pet, and listening to Focus 580 regularly.
Sure.
I'm not sure what sort of measurement one would use, but maybe something like hours per week that is spent in connected activities.
Right.
Where is the point where, where's the knee in the curve is what I'm searching for.
I mean, how much do you need to connect to get the benefit?
Yeah, to get to maximize, to optimize the benefit, I guess.
Yeah, that we don't know, and that's research that has to be done. I think, I'll tell you my hunch, and you can feel it in your gut. When you feel you're leading a connected life, you can feel it when it's too much, and you can feel it when it's not enough.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. So then, this will probably differ by individual.
Right. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
But there are a few basic markers. You know, do you have a love relationship? Do you have a community? Do you have an organization you belong to? But then you can be a connected person and have none of those. So that's why I hate to generalize. But feel in your gut, you know, do I feel connected? Do I feel a part of something larger than myself? Or do I not? And most people can answer that question fairly accurately if they'll try to be honest with themselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, the little question, I have what may be a technical cavil with your study at Exeter.
Yeah?
If you have an environment where academic performance, academic excellence is very highly valued.
Right.
And you have a distribution of people with respect to scholastic aptitude.
Yeah.
Some are going to do better and some are going to do worse.
Yeah.
And if then you go and you ask these people, hey, we're going to have a picnic this afternoon, would you like to go along? The ones who are doing well and feel confident are more likely to say yes than the people who feel that they're facing failure.
Sure, and we tried to control for that. I understand what you're saying. You're saying is a chicken or egg, and that's a very important and valid point. And we, you know, in the study design, tried to control for that by looking at the state people were in before they had a track record, before they were facing failure, you know, and that sort of thing. But I think the question you raise is very valid, and it you know, it's something that we discussed when we interpreted the data.
Uh-huh. Okay. Very interesting program. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We have about 5 minutes left with Edward Halliwell. He's a senior lecturer at Harvard Medical School and director of the Halliwell Center for Cognitive and Emotional Health in Massachusetts, and author of the book we're discussing, Connect, 12 Vital Ties That Open Your Heart, Lengthen Your Life, and Deepen Your Soul. And by the way, the spelling of his name, last name, Halliwell, H-A-L-L-O-W-E-L-L, for those who'd like to look for the book.
And if any listener wants to email me, I put my email on the inside flap jacket of the book. I would love to connect with any listener. The email address is ehalliwell, all one word, E-H-A-L-L-O-W-E-L-L, at AOL.com.
Very good. A brave man putting your email address on your book jacket.
Well, I'm, you know, I got to walk the walk, you know, and I want to connect, so... And I've gotten some wonderful responses,
yeah.
Really wonderful responses. People will email stories and anecdotes that they won't necessarily call into shows and share in public.
Yeah. Well, we have just about 4 minutes left, and I want to ask you about, you know, something that might get down to practicality in making connections, whether it's at a party or, you know, you're at some place and you meet somebody from Afghanistan or, you know, whether we're talking about a political situation and you know, there might be some disagreement about issues, but mm-hmm. you still want to have a conversation with folks, or maybe you're afraid to.
Mm-hmm.
And how to go about it? You counsel that the first thing that you must do is be patient.
Yes, yes. And listen. And then remember the content of the conversation. Let's say you're talking about meeting someone at a party or whatnot.
Yeah.
The content of the conversation is not nearly as important as the nonverbal part of it. So shake hands, make eye contact, you know, smile, do the things that you do to put someone else at ease. And then you can have a sparring discussion about politics or something you completely disagree about and find yourself very connected to that person. So the content is almost irrelevant. What matters is you're putting yourself in a frame of mind that you're willing to open up. You're willing to be vulnerable. You're willing to, you don't have to expose everything about yourself. I don't mean that at all. But you're willing to put yourself in a receptive frame of mind. I want to know this person. I want this person to know me a little bit anyway. I want to not fake it. I want to be genuine, you know. And if you work at not faking it, you know, the chances are you will connect in a genuine fashion. Because we are socially wired. You know, biology, nature wants us to connect. It's our fear system that prevents us, you know, and our mistrust system and our worry system. Sometimes just the speed of our lives prevent us because we're saying, well, gee, I'd like to talk to you, but I got to run.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes you might feel put off by somebody's first reaction, and that, you know, then you raise the second point that is important to keep in mind, and that's persistence.
Exactly, exactly. You're put off or you're apprehensive, and you the easiest thing to do, what adults do, is just disengage. If you're not clicking, if you're not seeing the signals you want to see, you just disengage. You walk away. You say, well, thanks, nice to talk to you. But inwardly, you're thinking, well, the heck with you. Instead of kind of persisting, bearing with the tension. Because in any meaningful connection, there will be a little bit of anxiety, a little bit of tension, a little bit of frustration. The other person isn't exactly what you want the other person to be. But bear with that. Persist with that. And then the connection will deepen.
Mm-hmm. There's another bit of advice you repeat several times in dealing with sort of the personal aspects of connection, and really how to get along in life and try to be healthy about things. And that advice is never worry alone.
So yes.
Connecting back to your other book.
Yes,
too.
Yes. Yeah. It's you know, life dishes out tough stuff for all of us, and the thing to do when you're having a hard time of it is not to be alone. Never worry alone. Connect, make contact. That's why I went from my worry book to my connect book, because the best antidote to excessive worry, and we're living in an epidemic of excessive worry these days, is to connect. I mean, what happened in Littleton, Colorado was all about disconnection. I mean, it's all about that. And if you want to protect your kids, connect with them and make sure the school they go to is a connected school. Much more important than what grades they're getting in school, by the way, is do they feel connected?
Well, we'll have to leave it there since we're here at the end of our time, and that's probably a good place to leave it. And I'll suggest for folks, there's much more in the book than we've had time to talk about, but if you'd like to read more, look for the book. The title is Connect, the subtitle 12 Vital Ties That Open Your Heart, Lengthen Your Life, and Deepen Your Soul. The author is Edward M. Hallowell, M.D. His last name is spelled H-A-L-L-O-W-E-L-L. And recently published by Pantheon Books. And to you, Dr. Hallowell, thanks very much once again for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Jack. It was a real pleasure to be on with you again.